Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take stacks of sources, research, and history and provide you with the essential knowledge you need to be truly well-informed.
Today, we're doing something really significant.
We are. We're undertaking a monumental task, a forensic deep dive into one of the most hotly contested documents in modern religious history, the Book of Abraham.
And this is such a crucial area of study for you, the learner. What we have here is a really unique scenario within scriptural claims.
How so?
Well, the document Joseph Smith claimed to have translated, the actual physical source material, it exists, we have it, and we can read it today.
So our mission here is to really dissect the friction between Smith's explicit translation claims from the 1830s and, you know, the verifiable scientific findings of modern Egyptology.
Exactly. That friction is everything.
That distinction verifiable evidence is what makes this deep dive so potent. Okay, so let's unpack the stakes immediately. Why is the Book of Abraham, or the BOA, so pivotal? Most people know it as part of the Pearl of Great Price.
It's fundamental. I mean, the BOA makes up roughly a quarter of the Mormon scriptural canon, what they often call the Quad. But its real existential significance is tied directly to Joseph Smith's core identity.
Right.
He's not just a prophet, seer, and revelator. He is explicitly titled Translator.
That title, Translator, that's the specific hinge upon which this entire discussion turns, isn't it?
Absolutely. Think about the Book of Mormon. It was supposedly translated from golden plates written in Reformed Egyptian, a language no one else could read.
And the plates were taken away. Yeah. Untouchable evidence.
Exactly. But the BOA, well, the BOA is the single most important verifiable test of his translating ability, precisely because the source material, the ancient Egyptian papyri, exists.
You can see it.
Modern scholars can put their eyes on the original documents and read them using linguistic tools developed long after Smith's time.
So if the translation of this one visible, testable document is demonstrably incorrect, the implications don't just affect the Book of Abraham.
Oh, no. It casts a massive shadow over the credibility of his entire claim to prophetic and revelatory power.
It creates a crisis of authority.
It does. If he got the translation of a document we can read wrong, a document written in a known ancient language, then how can we trust his claims about translating a document we cannot read, like a Book of Mormon?
The stakes truly are existential for anyone evaluating the historical foundation of the faith.
They really are.
Okay, let's set the historical stage for you. We're talking about the 1830s, specifically Kirtland, Ohio. What was the global mood at the time regarding ancient Egypt?
The world was gripped by a phenomenon called Egyptomania. It was a craze.
Right.
Napoleon's military expedition to Egypt in 1798 had sort of unintentionally triggered this massive outpouring of Egyptian artifacts into Europe and then into America.
So everyone was obsessed.
Intense obsession. Western interest in mummies, sarcophagi, and the mystery of hieroglyphics was at a fever pitch.
It was an era of profound curiosity about the ancient world.
Exactly. And Joseph Smith was operating right in the middle of this. We know he was intimately familiar with the Old Testament narratives, specifically Genesis,
which details Abraham's migration to Egypt.
Right. Chapter 12, due to a famine. So this narrative context predisposed him and his whole community to connect any Egyptian relics that appeared with the ancient patriarch Abraham.
They were looking for a link.
They were seeking evidence for biblical truths, and these Egyptian artifacts felt like a direct, tangible link to that ancient world.
Okay, that sets the perfect historical scene for phase one. The acquisition, the claim, and the time bomb. How did these relics, these literal time bombs, even arrive in Kirtland?
Well, the story starts in the summer of 1835. A man named Michael Chandler, he was an entrepreneur, arrived in Kirtland, Ohio.
Okay.
He was touring the country, selling a collection of mummies and several associated scrolls of papyri that he had acquired through a connection to an excavator named Antonio Lobolo.
So Chandler was basically running a traveling curiosity show, cashing in on that Egyptomania we just talked about.
Precisely. And he knew his audience. He found a very receptive and fascinated public in the Latter-day Saint community there.
And they decided they had to have him.
The church leadership and some prominent members decided these relics were too important, too potentially significant to just let them pass by.
And they purchased them. We really need to emphasize the cost here because this wasn't just, you know, a casual acquisition.
Not even close. A group of Latter-day Saints bought the remaining artifacts, four mummies, and the papyri for the staggering price of
$2,400. $2,400. So what does that mean in today's money?
To put that into perspective for you, in 1835, that's roughly equivalent to $68,000 today.
Wow. For a brand new church that was often broke?
For a nascent, frequently destitute religious movement constantly facing debt and financial crisis, this was a massive economic sacrifice. It shows the extraordinary value they placed on these documents from the get-go.
So they pay this exorbitant sum, and Smith gets his hands on the scrolls. What was his immediate claim after what was called a very brief inspection?
His claim was swift and monumental. According to his own history, he commenced the translation. He didn't hesitate at all. He immediately proclaimed, "Much to our joy, we found that one of the rolls contained the writings of Abraham."
Yeah, and the other.
"And another contained the writings of Joseph of Egypt."
The immediate, unambiguous nature of that claim is just crucial, isn't it? Yeah. Because he cemented it in print later on.
That's right. When the Book of Abraham was published in the church's newspaper, The Times and Seasons, in 1842, the claim was definitive, maximal.
What did it say exactly?
The publication heading announced it as a translation of some ancient records, purporting to be the writings of Abraham written by his own hand upon papyrus.
Written by his own hand. That phrasing, that absolute claim of literal personal authorship by the biblical Abraham, that removes all ambiguity.
It really does. It leaves absolutely no room for the modern defensive argument that it was a loose translation or, you know, just a revelation inspired by the papyri.
It creates a black and white test case.
It does. And to understand why Smith felt so confident making such a claim, we have to go back to that linguistic environment. He was translating in a perceived vacuum. Meaning, if the documents had been in Hebrew, scholars in America could have instantly fact-checked him. But since Egyptian hieroglyphics were still a mystery to most people, he could avoid scrutiny and claim unique, divine translation power.
He thought he had a unique advantage. But this whole process making these claims between 1835 and 1842 was happening under a rapidly closing window of global ignorance. This brings us to the actual time bomb, the Rosetta Stone.
The Rosetta Stone is arguably the single most important secular artifact to understanding the collapse of the Book of Abraham claims. It was discovered by Napoleon's troops in 1799.
But just finding it wasn't enough?
No, finding it was just the first step. Unlocking its secrets took two decades of painstaking international effort.
So for you, the learner, let's go into a little detail about how the stone actually worked. Why was it the key?
Because of the parallel texts. The stone has a royal decree on it. An agreement from a council of priests in 96 BC, but it's written in three distinct scripts.
Okay, what were they?
The top script was hieroglyphic, the formal picture writing of the priests. The middle was Demotic, a common everyday Egyptian script. And the bottom was ancient Greek.
And since Greek was a known language to scholars,
they could compare the texts. Scholars like Thomas Young in Britain, and more famously, Jean-François Champollion in France, could cross-reference the recurring royal names in the Greek text with the corresponding symbols in the other sections.
That was the breakthrough moment.
It was the foundational moment for modern Egyptology. By 1822, Champollion had conclusively cracked the code. He published the Principles for Reading Egyptian.
So the code was cracked in Europe in 1822. That's well before Smith even got the papyri in 1835. Why didn't scholars in the U.S. immediately call him out?
Well, that time lag is critical. Information moved very slowly across the Atlantic in the 1830s.
Right.
While Champollion had unlocked the language, the published grammar, the dictionaries, the full understanding that wasn't broadly known in America, especially not in frontier towns like Kirtland, until much later.
We're talking years later.
We're talking around 1858 or even later, before the full force of Egyptology really crossed the ocean.
So Joseph Smith was translating in what he thought was a linguistic vacuum, relying on global ignorance, but that ignorance was already disappearing.
Exactly. He had unwittingly laid a black and white test down at the exact moment the rest of the world was getting the tools to check his work.
It was a monumental historical coincidence.
A huge one. He placed an explicit, maximal, verifiable claim on a document in a language that was, unbeknownst to him, entering the mainstream of academic study. He effectively set a deadline on the validity of his claims.
Okay, so let's use those tools developed after the Rosetta Stone and move into phase two. The fundamental flaws, dating and content. The thing is, we don't even need to look at the translation of the characters yet, do we? The claims hit a wall immediately.
They do. The most immediate and irrefutable flaw is the dating. This requires zero specialized knowledge of hieroglyphs, just basic archaeology.
What's the date?
Expert consensus places the papyri fragments somewhere between the 3rd century BCE and the 1st century CE.
BCE, before the Common Era. So roughly 200 years before Christ to 100 years after.
Precisely. And this is critical because Abraham, if you treat him as a historical figure based on biblical chronology, is believed to have lived around 2000 BCE.
That's a staggering gap. That's at least 1,000 years of separation.
Possibly more. Between the supposed author and the date of the document, this fact alone makes the claim that it was written by his own hand physically impossible.
It is the ultimate refutation of that maximal claim. And here's where the sources get so powerful for you, the learner. This is not just a critique from outside sources.
No, it's not. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints itself, in its own official Gospel Topics essay on the Book of Abraham, concedes this exact point.
They admit it.
They state unequivocally that the fragments date long after Abraham lived.
The Church acknowledges the 1,000-year gap. That's a truly critical admission. Setting aside all the theological debate for a moment.
It's the foundation of the case.
Right.
But let's look at the source material's true nature. These scrolls were bought with mummies. They were found in burials. What would any Egyptologist expect to find?
Documents relating to the deceased, burial rites, the journey through the afterlife, something like that.
Exactly. And that is precisely what they are. Early Egyptologists who got a look at the facsimiles, and later the fragments, immediately identified them as common Egyptian funerary texts.
So parts of the Book of the Dead or something similar?
Right. Not a rare, unique royal decree or a historical biography.
We were basically mass-produced funeral documents.
Yes.
That's a good way to put it. Gustav Seyfarth, as early as 1856, identified the roll as an invocation to the deity Osiris. Theodore de Varia, a prominent figure at the Louvre, wrote in 1912 that the facsimiles were common Egyptian funerary documents of which he had examined hundreds.
Hundreds.
They are boilerplate ritual texts to help the deceased on their journey. Finding an autobiography of Abraham among them would be like finding the Declaration of Independence written inside a modern funeral program.
It just doesn't fit the context at all.
Not in the slightest.
Now, this issue was clouded for many decades because the actual source papyri were believed to have been lost.
Right, in the infamous Chicago fire of 1871. So for a long time, all the church had were the published images, the facsimiles.
But how did the source material re-enter the equation?
This is a fascinating bit of archival luck. In 1966, fragments of the original papyri, which had been sold after Joseph Smith's death, were rediscovered in the collections of the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art.
And they were eventually given back to the church.
Yes. And crucially, the fragments they recovered included the material that surrounded facsimile 1 and perfectly matched the manuscript Smith had used.
So after nearly a century of arguing over lost evidence, the source material was definitively available, verifiable. What was the absolute final word when both Mormon and non-Mormon Egyptologists analyzed those fragments?
The consensus was absolute, and again, the church had to officially acknowledge it. We look back to that same Gospel Topics essay.
What does it say?
None of the characters on the papyrus fragments mention Abraham's name or any of the events recorded in the Book of Abraham.
That's pretty definitive.
It goes on to state that Egyptologists universally agree the characters do not match the translation given in the Book of Abraham.
That is not a technical disagreement over semantics. That is a complete structural failure of the core claim.
A total failure.
The documents are 1,000 years too young, and they do not contain the name or the narrative they claim to contain. It's definitive.
It truly is. But the story doesn't end there, because to understand the mechanics of Smith's mistranslation and his methodology, we have to look closely at the pictures he published, the ones he annotated and claimed to translate figure by figure.
These are the smoking guns.
Exactly.
Okay, let's transition into phase three. The smoking guns in the facsimiles. These three published images provide the most visually compelling, testable evidence because Joseph Smith gave specific figure by figure interpretations.
And we begin with facsimile 1. This is probably the most famous image associated with the Book of Abraham, the scene with a figure on a couch surrounded by animals and a standing priest-like figure.
Smith's published translation is very dramatic. It claims the scene depicts Abraham fastened upon an altar, about to be sacrificed by an idolatrous priest of Elkanah.
And then the angel of the Lord intervenes, symbolized by the flying bird. He's claiming attempted human sacrifice and divine deliverance.
Okay. Now let's apply Egyptology. What is this scene actually depicting?
It's a very common ritual image. It's a funerary scene. The figure on the table is the deceased Hor, the owner of this particular papyrus, being prepared for burial in his afterlife journey.
And the priest-like figure standing over him.
That figure is the god Anubis. the jackal-headed god of embalming in the underworld. He's shown tending to the deceased.
Not a priest trying to kill him.
Not at all. The bird is the Ba, or the spirit of Hor, which leaves the body at death but returns. The vessels underneath are canopic jars holding the internal organs. It is a scene of reverent preparation, not violent sacrifice.
That is a total disconnect. Preparation for the afterlife versus attempted murder. But the errors here are even more dramatic because the original document was damaged.
Yes.
Joseph Smith didn't just misidentify known figures. He had to literally draw in the missing parts, what scholars call lacuna, to support his story.
This is the moment where the claim moves from mere mistranslation to active fabrication of evidence.
Also,
the figure of Anubis should have a distinct stylized jackal head. The papyrus was broken right there. So Smith filled in the gap, but he added a human head instead of the jackal head.
Turning the god of embalming into the idolatrous priest.
Exactly. And the weapon.
He added a weapon.
He crudely added a large knife to the priest's hand. This knife was necessary to indicate sacrifice in his story, but it wasn't present in the original fragment. It's just not something you see in embalming scenes.
And these additions were visible in the 1842 publication.
They were. He essentially manufactured the visual evidence he needed to make the funerary scene look like a story about Abraham.
That's truly stunning. It's not just a linguistic error. It's an iconographic forgery applied directly to the ancient document.
It speaks volumes about his conviction, or maybe the need to make the document match the story he'd already revealed.
Let's move to facsimile 2, the hypocephalus. This is that circular document that looks like a wheel covered in figures.
A hypocephalus literally means under the head. It's a magical disc that was placed beneath the mummy's head.
For what purpose?
Its purpose was to magically ensure the deceased's resurrection and to provide warmth and spiritual light in the afterlife. It represents the sun god Ra rising.
And crucially, this hypocephalus was from a different scroll entirely.
Completely different. It belonged to a deceased man named Shishank, not Hor from facsimile 1, and certainly not Abraham. Smith confused his source material, attributing multiple different funerary scrolls to a single record.
So he's already combining and misattributing records. Now let's get to the most infamous error on this disc.
That would be figure 7. Joseph Smith translated the specific figure as God sitting upon his throne, revealing through the heavens the grand keywords of the priesthood.
A profound theological moment tying directly into the temple theology he was developing in Nauvoo.
Exactly. Revealing the deepest secrets of the cosmos and the priesthood.
And the reality.
The reality is that the figure is the Egyptian god, Min.
Min.
Min is the god of fertility, harvest, and procreation, and he is invariably depicted with an erect phallus.
Wow. Okay. Min, the fertility god, completely unconnected to the grand keywords of the priesthood. The contrast is spectacular.
And this detail caused immense embarrassment when Egyptology became common knowledge. The existence of a deity depicted with an erect phallus at the core of a document claimed to be scripture was problematic for 19th century American sensibilities.
What did they do?
The church actually chose at one point to censor the image, removing the erect penis from some published printings of the facsimile.
Wait, they altered the image of the claimed ancient scripture to avoid public embarrassment.
They did, and this alteration itself became a huge scandal later, since it was direct tampering. They had to eventually reattach the detail in later printings due to scholarly pressure, but it highlights the lengths they went to.
There's also the section he claimed he couldn't translate, where he just created a theological mystery.
Yes. For one section of hieroglyphic text, Smith gave up on translation and instead wrote that it contains writings that cannot be revealed unto the world, but is to be had in the holy temple of God.
So he's creating ambiguity and connecting it to the emerging temple ceremonies.
Exactly. He's inviting members to invest deep, sacred meaning into unknown characters.
What does that mysterious, unrevealable section actually say, according to Egyptologists?
It's a standard pedestrian funerary dedication. The text reads, "Grant that the soul of Osiris Shishank may live."
So it's just wishing the dead guy well.
It's simply referring to the deceased man the hypocephalus was buried with, wishing him well in the afterlife. Stripped entirely of the complex mystical meanings Smith imposed on it.
Finally, let's examine facsimile 3. This image is, as you said, the clearest test, because Smith translates not just the figures, but the adjacent columns of hieroglyphic characters themselves.
This is where we get the clearest linguistic failures, because we can check his translation of specific words and names against the Rosetta Stone's foundation.
Let's start with the gender and title errors.
Smith translates the central female goddess Isis, one of the most important deities in the entire Egyptian pantheon, as King Pharaoh.
He also mistranslates the female goddess Ma'at, the goddess of truth and justice,
as Prince of Pharaoh, King of Egypt.
A female goddess is translated as a male king. How significant is that?
It's a catastrophic failure of basic linguistic and cultural comprehension. It shows he completely misunderstood the entire iconographic system, the foundational grammar, and the difference between gendered figures.
And he mistakes the title Pharaoh for a name.
Right. Dr. Robert Rittner, a leading Egyptologist, noted that no amount of special pleading can change the female Isis into the male king of Pharaoh. It's just impossible.
So he misidentified the person, got the gender wrong, and confused the title for a name all in one sentence.
Yes, but perhaps the most culturally telling error is the race and slavery error. Smith identifies a figure in the facsimile, which is actually the god Anubis again, as a slave belonging to the prince.
Why?
Because the figure is depicted with black skin.
This sounds like a 19th century interpretation being imposed onto an ancient context.
It absolutely is. Anubis is traditionally depicted in black, representing the color of embalming resin and the fertile black soil of Egypt, symbolizing regeneration.
But Smith saw something else.
He saw a black figure and imposed the contemporary 19th century theological framework of the curse of Cain or curse of Ham onto it, linking dark skin to slavery and cursed lineage. It's a clear case of him reading his own cultural theology into the ancient art.
Was there any physical alteration to this image as well?
High-resolution analysis suggests that, similar to facsimile 1, the jackal snout of Anubis in facsimile 3 was crudely altered, maybe chipped off the woodcut to make the head look more human.
To make it fit the idea of a slave-like figure.
Exactly. The cumulative evidence of facsimiles 1 and 3 suggests a pattern of physically altering the visual representations to support the invented narrative.
We've covered the results of the incorrect translation. Now we move into phase 4, the mechanism of mistranslation. We actually have source material that demonstrates the flawed methodology itself. This is where we discuss the document known as the Grammar and Alphabet of the Egyptian Language, or GAEL.
The GAEL is essential. It is a window into Joseph Smith's mind and the structural foundation of his failure. This document shows his attempt, along with scribes like W.W. Phelps, to systematize Egyptian characters and assign specific meanings and rules to them. It was created in 1835.
And for decades, this document was intentionally kept hidden from the general membership of the church. Why?
Because it reveals the method, and the method is entirely fabricated. The GAL is his attempt to create an Egyptian dictionary from scratch, assigning elaborate multi-paragraph definitions to single symbols.
So any real Egyptologist would have immediately recognized it as?
As pseudolinguistics. The methodology itself proves the translation process was wholly invalid. It was only uncovered when the documents were rediscovered in the 1960s.
What is the core linguistic flaw that the GAL exposes? You called it the word count problem.
This is the fundamental misunderstanding of information density. Smith and the GAL operate on the belief that a single Egyptian character could represent entire sentences or even paragraphs.
They thought one symbol contained a massive amount of hidden text.
Right. They assign degrees of meaning to characters, believing that by adding a few squiggles, you exponentially increase the amount of text generated.
Which fundamentally is not how ancient Egyptian works.
Absolutely not. Ancient Egyptian, like most languages, has characters that represent sounds or single concepts. They are not condensed paragraphs waiting to be unlocked. Smith was attempting what linguists call hyper-translation, deriving thousands of words from a tiny handful of characters.
And we have a perfect, devastating example of this in the source text, demonstrating the difference between his belief and the linguistic reality.
We do. This comes directly from the analysis of the recovered fragments. Egyptologists examined the symbols on the papyri that correspond to the very beginning of the Book of Abraham.
What did they find?
They found two adjacent Egyptian symbols, a phonetic spelling sign and a determinative symbol that signifies water. Together, these two symbols unequivocally mean the single, simple word, lake.
One word, lake.
Joseph Smith took those two symbols, that single word, and translated them into four separate verses of the Book of Abraham text, specifically Abraham 1.1 to 15.
Four verses from the word lake.
The expansion is staggering. From one common noun, he derived an entire narrative about the idolatrous priest of Elkanah, the attempts to sacrifice Abraham, and Abraham's prayers for deliverance.
So he didn't just get the word wrong mistaking lake for priest. He misinterpreted the linguistic density by a factor of hundreds. This single example is proof of a flawed methodology.
It's the smoking gun in the text itself. It shows the translation was a process of imaginative expansion, not linguistic decoding. The few lines of recovered papyrus wouldn't be nearly enough to generate the entire five-chapter Book of Abraham.
Now, all this evidence, the dating, the funerary content, the errors in the facsimiles, the GAL methodology, forces the modern church to confront Smith's original claims.
It does, and this is where the apologetic defense comes in.
Because from 1835 through 1842, Joseph Smith was unequivocal. His journal has at least 9 entries where he uses the words translation and translating to describe his work.
He was claiming literal linguistic conversion. The publication title claimed it was written by his own hand.
But since modern science, enabled by the Rosetta Stone, confirms the translation as false, the narrative has to shift.
It must. The modern apologetic necessity is to redefine translation entirely. They now argue the papyri were merely a catalyst for revelation.
A catalyst.
The idea is that the physical scrolls acted as a trigger, allowing Smith to receive prophetic revelation from God about Abraham, even though the content of that revelation had nothing to do with the actual Egyptian characters on the scroll.
That is a remarkable shift in definition.
It is a radical revision that directly contradicts Smith's own repeated, explicit claims that he was translating the text written by Abraham. This theological workaround only became necessary once the Rosetta Stone definitively closed the door on the literal translation claim.
So, what does this all mean? Let's just synthesize the case we've built for you, the learner. We have followed a clear forensic path through the sources.
The story of the Book of Abraham is essential because it is, at its core, a simple case. It's built on converging evidence that is testable and verifiable. Joseph Smith put forward explicit claims about a visible document.
And the scientific tools developed in the mid-19th century proved those claims false.
First, the dating. The documents are common funerary texts, 1,000 years too young for Abraham to have written them, a fact now conceded by the church.
Second, the content. They are boilerplate burial rituals for the deceased Hor and Shushank, not historical biographies of a biblical patriarch. The church concedes the name Abraham isn't even on the scroll.
Third, the specific visual errors. Joseph Smith not only fundamentally mistranslated the images in the facsimiles, confusing embalming for sacrifice, fertility gods for God the Father, and female goddesses for male kings.
But he also appears to have physically altered the documents, adding the knife, censoring the phallus, altering the Anubis snout to fit his revealed narrative.
And finally, the methodology. The JAL and the failure to translate the single word lake into 4 verses demonstrate a catastrophic linguistic misunderstanding. It proves the process was one of expansive invention, not genuine decoding.
The knowledge unlocked by the Rosetta Stone simply provided the universal dictionary required to confirm what early critics had suspected. Joseph Smith could not read ancient Egyptian.
There really is no middle ground between embalming ritual and sacrifice of Abraham.
This is a foundational story for anyone seeking to critically evaluate historical religious claims. It underscores the importance of not just faith, but the necessity of critical thinking and relying on factual evidence.
It really does.
And that leads us to a final question for you. Mm-hmm. Something to think about as you navigate this complex information.
If Joseph Smith was able to convince thousands of followers that these common funerary texts, dated a millennium after the alleged author, were literally written by Abraham's own hand, and this was done in a window of time just before the tools to disprove his claims became widely known,
then what does this entire incident reveal about the tension between prophetic authority and historical accountability?
And how must we, as modern learners, adjust our standards of evidence when evaluating claims that rely on those kinds of linguistic vacuums?
A truly challenging question for any learner in the modern age. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.